I was 12 years old and in seventh grade when I learned about betrayal. I had a teacher that I adored. She was smart, and she didn't treat us like children. She didn't care, or didn't seem to care, that I was terribly awkward, that we were all so awkward, and with really bad haircuts. I loved her. But then one day, I went to school, and she was gone. No one would say exactly where or when she'd be back. The substitute tried to explain she wasn't well. She needed to go get better. I couldn't help but wonder, was it our fault? And could we fix it? It was very confusing. There were rumors about what had happened, but no one would say for sure. Don't worry, they said. It has nothing to do with you. Now, my daughter today, she is about the same age as I was when all this happened. And what I realize now is that when you try to tell a 12-year-old not to take something personally, not so much, right? Everything is personal to a 12-year-old. So I was sure that my teacher had left me personally, left us personally. The year was ruined and I was ruined. And more than this, I was worried about her. I wondered if she was okay. I missed her. Before too long, this worry and love turned to anger and hurt. How could she just leave in the middle of the year? And why didn't she say anything before she went? Didn't she love us? Didn't she love me? Didn't we have a deal? I felt betrayed. Now, I start with this story because betrayal is the best way that I know for us to start making sense of covenant. Covenant, as Sean said, is this month's theme, and it is what I would call the core teaching of Unitarian Universalism. The problem is, however, the idea and the word covenant, it can feel kind of academic, I know, dry, emotionally inaccessible, boring, irrelevant, any of these. Which is why we must start with betrayal, which is sort of the opposite, the other side of the coin of covenant. Because unlike the idea of covenant, betrayal is visceral. Betrayal tells you in your gut what you care about, what is at stake, what piece of the world you thought you were working on together. And most of all, it tells you who can betray you, who matters enough that you would call something they did betrayal. You can only be betrayed by someone you trust, someone you love, someone who is in one way or another your partner, or at least someone you thought was your partner. Betrayal reveals a break in the trust, a break in the partnership, a break of mutuality and love. It was betrayal, in fact, that led to one of the origins of the concept of covenant. The covenants that we find in the story of Genesis, stories of Genesis. Before there was covenant, there was betrayal. God felt betrayed. Where God expected mutuality, reciprocity, trust, and love, the Hebrew people who he thought he had a covenant with, the Hebrew people were pretty standoffish. And because God felt betrayed, God did a terrible, vengeful thing. God destroyed everything. All of life, all of creation, except Noah, this one guy, Noah, and of course the two by two animals. Now, if you read the story of the flood, really read it, go back to the text in Genesis, it is not like the children's story that many of us come to know. This picture of the ark that ends up in babies' rooms, I mean, baby blankets. I mean, really, the story is terrible, right? God destroys everything, everything, except this one guy and his wife, right? It's terrible. So terrible that even God has remorse. Even God realizes that God went too far and promises never, ever, ever to do that again. This is the covenant that we inherit. God promises that even if God thinks creation isn't doing enough, and even if the people think God isn't doing enough, even if they feel betrayed or hurt or disappointed, even then they won't give up. Even then, they will keep on being partners and will keep building the world together. Now, the ancient Hebrew people, whose stories these are, were making some important faith claims when they told this story. Claims about the story of God, the sort of God that was their God. Now, even as we may rightfully be appalled about the God who would destroy life so terribly, they were also making the claim that their God was a God who has remorse and who learns. Maybe terrible loss has happened. Maybe the sort of destruction you can't believe God would let happen. But this is a God who's learning and who's trying to do better. If you know devastation, you can perhaps understand why this sort of God would be appealing. And the ancient Israelites, they knew devastation. Now, more than just about God, they were also making claims about themselves, because they were a community that affirmed that humans were made in God's image. So they were also saying, we can learn, we can do better, even if we have done terrible things, even if we were betrayed or were the betrayers. Maybe some of us can appreciate this as well, this idea that we're still learning and we can do better. Most importantly, this story makes claims about life itself, which is that the worst thing that could happen is behind us. Nothing anyone does or says or doesn't do, nothing will lead to that worst thing happening again. That was the deal. So the Puritans in the 17th century, as Sean said, they felt there was a lot of good news in this deal. And so they picked it up as one of their core practices to be a part of this covenant, this shared promise among all of creation and something greater than all of creation. This line from the Puritans to our Unitarian Universalist congregations today, it is pretty straightforward. So that our covenantal way is a direct inheritance from those pilgrims making their way across the sea. We have, over these years, drafted many different words to express our covenantal promises. Some from the early church, it's true, you may not recognize as our religious kin. They read a lot more like creeds. But the concept of covenant is still there. We are a covenantal rather than a creedal tradition. It is our through line. We come together not through shared beliefs, but shared promises. Not what we believe, but what we believe in. What we will commit our lives to, be faithful to, serve, create, and love. If you've been a part of a Unitarian Universalist congregation for any length of time, I'm sure you've been asked many times what we UUs believe. Believe, say, about the Bible or God or Jesus. And while there are many things we might say are common beliefs among us about any of these or other things, ultimately our answers to these questions are not what define us as a community of faith. So you might end up saying things like, well, some UUs believe in the Bible as scripture. Others believe it's an important historical and sociological text with good stories. Others want nothing to do with it. Or you might say, some UUs believe in God. Others believe in that God's a word to describe a force or an energy of love. Still others don't believe in God at all. Now, all of these, when you say them, you might have noticed, leave the person who asked with a great puzzled look on their face. And no wonder. These are creedal questions, and we are a covenantal faith. So none of these get at what binds us together, what defines us as a religion. To get to the heart of who we are, you have to ask different questions. Questions like, what do we consider most worthy of our shared mutual loyalty? To what do we dedicate our lives? To whom or to what are we accountable? When the Puritans first arrived in New England, they realized they had no idea how any of the others around them would answer these important kinds of questions. They were all virtual strangers. Other than having survived that harrowing trip across the sea and having been motivated to take the trip in the first place, they weren't sure if they actually had anything in common. And so before they did anything else in their quest to begin this new way of being together, they began just getting to know each other. They talked and talked, debated. You can see through line right to us. They also listened and reflected, gathered in small groups and across town, especially around these matters of love and loyalty. They shared meals, and they grew in their understanding, their friendship, and their care. Now, they could have stopped there, because they were, by then, a good community, friends and neighbors who looked out for each other. But they realized that community wasn't enough. They wanted something bigger, something that was for more than just themselves, connected them to something greater, something more official, formal, intentional. They needed covenant. Now, sometimes people ask me if instead of this stuffy, sometimes off-putting word covenant, if we could just use the word promise or commitment. You can, but you lose something when you do. Covenant, after all, is the religious word. It's what links us to the roots in our religious tradition and our community. Covenant isn't casual. It isn't when we have time or whenever we run into each other. Covenant is a promise made freely over and over again. There is no coercion in a covenant. It is a promise of love and loyalty, not legalism and requirements. Sometimes in wedding ceremonies, I remind the couples that your yes today matters not at all if you do not discover your new yes every day, every moment. Sometimes we know it is harder to find the yes than other times, which is why Rebecca Parker describes covenant as given in grace, yet sustained by practice. Covenants are a promise of the present as we seek to create the future, but they are also rooted in our past. Covenant says we come from something. We are a part of something. We did not make ourselves, and we need each other now, need to walk together. The root of the word, after all, covenir, means to travel together. It is that traveling together that is the point of covenant. As a church too often steeped in individualism, covenant is our corrective. Covenants often include particular promises, but the particular promises aren't the point. The promises just are a way of forging the relationship, the partnership, and the partnership is the point. Which brings us back to betrayal, or other ways that a covenant might be broken. The promises of a covenant represent our greatest hopes and aspirations, which means they are always too lofty to fulfill. When a covenant is broken, that's when, not if. It is the relationship that must be upheld, the relationship that must be tended to, cared for, which means repair of the break comes not from keeping score, or from retribution, or of pointing out methodically the broken promise as if it was a rule. Repair comes from the tasks of deep listening, empathy, forgiveness, restoration, and again, grace. This is the most challenging part of covenant, and yet it is also where the biggest blessing comes. When we stick around after the broken promises, do the work of calling back, of redemption and transformation, when we are the mosaic makers, creating something even more beautiful than before. Covenants are ultimately a practice of mutual accountability. One of my favorite parts of the 1648 Cambridge Platform, which is a founding document for us as a covenantal tradition, in there is a practice of admonishment. Talk about a loaded word, right? It's not a word we use too much anymore. I don't know how it sits with you. Sounds kind of harsh, admonishment. But actually, when you read the Cambridge Platform, it's not how it's written at all. It's written as a practice of love, of calling back, of knowing someone so well that when you see them heading off course, you invite them back to themselves. I've been admonished like that, even by some of you. And it doesn't feel harsh, not when it's done in love from that place. It just feels like belonging, like promise, like goodness and joy, even if it's hard in the moment. We make covenants with our spouses, our children, and our whole family. We make covenants with our friends, our teachers, with the earth, and with life itself. Some of these are explicit, most of them are not. Whether we realize it or not, covenants fill our whole lives, or at least the most important parts of our lives. We don't often tell our life stories like as a series of promises or commitments, but we could. It would tell a lot. When I say that covenant is our core teaching, I mean that what Unitarian Universalism has to offer, it, our tool, our guidepost, is how to engage and practice these covenants, how to keep saying yes. And most of all, what we're up to here in our congregational covenant is practice for all of these. Church is, as James Luther Adams said, the place where we practice being human together. And we are made human by our promises, our commitments we make to others, to ourselves, to something greater than all. This something greater is always present in a covenant. Adams described this as the creative, sustaining, commanding, transforming power that could be interpreted theistically or atheistically. Either way, it is that element that is not within our tangible control, that grace that we depend upon, even for our freedom. It includes all the history and people and forces that brought us each to this moment in history, all the promises of those who came before, and it asks you, what promise does your life make? Finally, though a covenant forms a relationship between and among people and something greater, it isn't actually for the benefit of the promise makers. The blessing of the covenant, of that relationship made there, must be given away, offered out as justice and service. The direction of the covenant, the force of its blessing, is always looking out beyond its participants. Blessings held too tightly are a club, not a covenant. Our walk together transforms our people, who in turn transform the world. Now, sometimes when I speak about covenant, I just go right to that story that Sean told, because all the ingredients are there. Our covenantal faith acknowledges that if we're going to do any big thing, anything, say, for example, try to finish the world, then we're going to need partners. We're going to need many, many partners, and that partnership is going to have to include an awareness of something beyond us, however we might name or conceive of it. Along the way in this work and in our partnership, it's a guarantee we're going to feel like we're too tiny, too little, and like none of us have the plans. And so we make a promise to work together, to discover and create that path together. Sometimes we know that one or the other of us is going to think that we're not doing enough, or that we're not doing things the way that we'd like them to be done. But even then, our faith says we need to keep trying, keep practicing. Even then, we can't give up. Even then, we must repair and admonish in love and forgive and do better and learn and grow, redeem and transform. Not out of obligation, but out of love and loyalty. That's the deal. Our covenantal way is our practice of this deal. It's our path, and it's also where we're headed towards, our means and our ends, our practice and our vision, a sustained and sustaining, transformed and transforming partnership with all of life. Let us keep practicing and keep saying yes. Amen, and blessed be.